Mr. Hayden, would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
5 minutes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden. I represent Marquez Perkins, who was convicted of seven felony counts, including robbery and also malicious wounding, use of a firearm, and commission of felony. One issue that was assigned as error was whether or not the trial court erred in allowing hearsay evidence to be propounded by the prosecution of testimony of a co-defendant, or rather alleged co-conspirator, where the statements were clearly made after the person's in custody.
The criminal agreed that was error, so the only issue there is whether it was harmless error.
That's correct. And I certainly appreciate the Commonwealth's frank acknowledgement that this was impermissible evidence. I would submit that that this was not harmless error. Before a federal constitutional error can be held harmless, the reviewing court must be able to declare a belief that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Otherwise, the conviction under review must be set aside. That's the Virginia Supreme Court speaking in the Lilly case back in 1999, quoting Chapman versus California, the U.S. Supreme Court case. They noted that the analysis turns on not on the evidence excluded, but on the evidence in the record, the witness's testimony, which was not fully.
Mr. Hayden, let me stop you in terms of that. The court here specifically indicated that it gave a great deal of credibility to the alleged victim when it was finding or making its finding of guilt. So would that not satisfy the constitutional burden?
I don't think so, because
it never mentioned this hearsay evidence.
That's correct.
That's true, but the witness, the victim in this case, was essentially uncertain whether he got struck by a firearm or what. And that's essentially proving the element of use of a firearm in a commission of felony. And he did in his statement that he wrote out to the police. He never mentioned the use of a firearm. At trial, he says that he thinks it was a firearm, but he says, "Well, I was struck from behind by a hard object. I think it was probably a firearm," but he really didn't know for certain. And what exactly he'd been struck with? Well, then this improper hearsay evidence that was introduced, there was the officer repeating the co-defendant's statement that, "Well, I saw Marquez Perkins take out the firearm," and he described exactly the caliber and the make of the firearm, and he used it to strike. That substantiated what otherwise had been weak evidence about a firearm having actually been used in the commission. And certainly those firearm charges, one cannot say, just based on what the evidence in the record was, other than proper evidence, that there really was a firearm used. But with this improper hearsay evidence that there was no opportunity to cross-examine about, it allowed the court to conclude, yep, really was a firearm, all right, and that was used. And so certainly that evidence there suggests the court, I would submit, can't declare a belief that the evidence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to the firearm element of those offenses, certainly. So this was not a situation where the evidence was cumulative about the existence of firearm. This was the presence of evidence tending to corroborate the suggestion that there was, in fact, a firearm use. And so it's not harmless error. This, we can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't affect the trial of facts decision with respect to those charges. If there are no other questions, I'll just rely on the remainder of my time for the. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for me.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Good morning. May it please the court. Unless the court wants to hear from me, I wouldn't reiterate why I submit that there was error both by the trial court and the single judge of this court on this confrontation clause issue, and I'll move straight to the harmless error aspect. I would submit, first of all, this defendant was convicted of robbery, conspiracy to commit felony, malicious wounding, two firearm counts. I take counsel's argument to tacitly concede that any error with respect to the robbery, the conspiracy, and the malicious wounding was, in fact, harmless. He hadn't said anything today about those particular crimes. He has emphasized instead the firearm counts. So, again, I take that as a tacit acknowledgement that for those three offenses, any error was harmless. And that makes sense because the only thing he's talked about is any uncertainty on the part of the victim as to the use of a gun. That obviously has nothing to do with all of the rest of his testimony that on its face would strongly suggest there was a conspiracy, a robbery, and malicious wounding. Now, as to the firearm counts, as Judge Frank has noted today, the judge, and we have the benefit here of the judge giving some reasoning for his verdict, he never ever alluded to this co-defendant's testimony given by the detective. It's also true that...
But counsel, is it fair to say that in light of the evidence where there were admittedly statements that the alleged victim gave that were somewhat in conflict, that the co-defendant's statements that came in could not have affected the court's judgment beyond that reasonable doubt?
I think the co-defendant's statements had no impact or certainly not enough to demonstrate the harmfulness of the error. For example, if I understood counsel correctly, he indicated the co-defendant had seen the defendant with the gun. Well, if you look at page 52 of the appendix, and I've noted this in my brief, in the course of quoting the co-defendant's account of what happened, which again the trial judge didn't even hint at any reliance upon, the detective was asked, did he say anything about the co-defendant having a gun? Answer, he had made statements saying that he had seen Mooney, that's the defendant, with a gun. But when I questioned further, he didn't want to get into the exact times he saw Mooney with a gun. So for all we know, it could have been two days earlier. It hardly was the straw that broke the camel's back for the defense on the firearm counts. So his testimony, which the trial court apparently didn't even consider, not surprisingly, because he gave so many versions of what happened, certainly didn't seal the defendant's fate on the firearm counts. I would just briefly, this to some degree bleeds over to the sufficiency claim, but I would just, again, in connection with the fact that the trial court expressly credited the victim's account, I would just point to his trial testimony that strongly indicates, certainly to the point of rendering any claimed error, I don't want to say claimed error because there was error here with respect to the co-defendant's statement, but I think the victim's account, which the trier of fact expressly credited, I think speaks for itself. Just quote from three or four quick passages, page 14 of the appendix. I felt somebody walking behind me. When I turned around, I've seen the defendant holding a pistol up in the air like he was about to hit me. Page 15, within 5 to 10 seconds, that's when the co-defendant hit me from the right. And then going on further, At the same time I was being hit, that's when I got hit in the back of the head with something. I believe it was that pistol that I just saw that came from the direction of the defendant, right. He's asked to describe it, then at page 15 to 16. All I know was it was a black handgun. And says, you call how many times you were hit? No, because I believe after the first hit I was knocked out. You mean first hit by the object as opposed to the fist? Right. And then I think maybe one other place I would direct the court's attention to. Today, page 32, today you're testifying you were struck with a gun. I said that that was the last weapon I seen. When I turned around, I didn't see what I was hit with. I seen a weapon in his hand when I turned around, but when I turned back around, I couldn't see what I was hit with. I think the testimony collectively strongly indicated it was a gun that the defendant had employed. Anything that he'd said before that is after he'd been maliciously wounded and knocked unconscious and was trying to, like the boxer knocked to the canvas, gets up and tries to clear his senses. So I would submit that the error with respect to the co-defendant's statement was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It plainly was, I submit, harmless as to three of the offenses, and as to the two firearm counts, I submit it was harmless as well for the reasons that I've advanced here and on brief. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'd ask it to affirm.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden?
Your Honors, I would not, if there was some implication I was conceding with regard to the other charges, that was not my intention. I'm not conceding on that. I would note that there were aspects of the other charges besides the firearms charges where there was problems with the testimony. For example, although Otis White purported to identify Perkins as one of the two persons that struck him in the head and robbed him, there, he acknowledged that he was struck from behind, that he was knocked out by the first blow that he suffered to the back of his head. He said, I don't know how many times I was hit because I believe after the first hit I was knocked out. Now, White presumed that the person who struck him must have been Perkins because he had seen him about 10 seconds earlier when he turns around and sees sees several persons. He saw what he thought was a firearm in Perkins' hand. And then he turns back around and he says, well, this person will never rob me in the presence of his mother. And then the next thing he knows, he's hit. He presumes that it must have been Perkins that did it with the firearm, but he didn't really know for a fact.
But Mr. Hayden, he's struck by the co-defendant with a fist that's to his side before he's struck in the head, correct?
That's correct, actually. And so he actually said that, that the first blow is the one that knocks him out. So he doesn't...
He says that he's punched. He didn't say that's the blow that knocks him out. It's the blow from behind that knocks him out. So I guess if you're indicating that the co-defendant was behind him, would that testimony be contradictory to that position?
He acknowledged in his statement that he said, someone hit me from behind, unquote. Someone, he says. Nowhere in his statement he gave to the police on page 27, he acknowledged that nowhere in his statement that he named Marquez Perkins as the person he suspected had struck him from behind. White further acknowledged on page 34 of the appendix that there was no mention of a gun in the statement he gave to the police. At trial, he testifies and about having been he talks about having been struck with a gun. Let's see if I can find it here. But I'm having a difficulty locating the precise place. But I believe what my recollection is that he says, first blow knocks me out, I'm struck, and I don't know what happened exactly after that. So there's a presumption, but it's not, that can't really say positively. He infers it must be Perkins, but he doesn't really know who delivered that first blow. And so I would note that harmless error analysis is not simply a sufficiency of the evidence analysis. And error does not affect the verdict, the judgment, if the reviewing court can determine without usurping the trier of facts, fact-finding function, that had the error not occurred, the verdict, the result would have been the same. And I would submit that one can't say that here. I would note that the statement of Justin Williams in talking to the detective, that the detective Jones repeats, he says that Williams said that I believe he said it was black, the handgun. He believed it was a semi-automatic 380. He said that Money did have a gun before, a black 380. I did not specify, he says on page 54, he did not specify that night. But then he does say he admits to being with Benita Perkins at home with Marquez Perkins on March the 4th, 2014. And then he says statements that tend to increase the culpability of the defendant. He says, I only got $100 from this, the thousands of dollars that was taken, or $1,000, or is he only got $100. He said that it was Perkins' idea to do the thing. He says, he said actually it's $5,000. It was the detective tells him $5,000 was taken, and Williams says, well, I only got $100, and so that's tending. And he's saying that the whole idea for the robbery comes from Perkins. These are facts that tend to shift blame onto the defendant for, and that we don't know that that doesn't affect the trier fact in terms of even assessing punishment and so on later on. This hearsay evidence that was clearly improper. So I submit that the standard is that one cannot say that the verdict would have been exactly the same but for this improper evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.